to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 6th of February, 2023, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's the beginning of another week, so that means we are here to discuss news of interest to British nationalists, and who better to discuss that with than Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing? I think there's a bit of a spring feel in the air. What's life like where you are, anyway?
Yeah, I think the weather just recently has been milder than it has been in the past. And I was out and about yesterday, and it was definitely quite a mild day, actually. So, yeah, I think spring is in the air, and that can only be a good thing.
Yeah, I've heard the snowdrops are out as well, and it's getting warmer, and we've got longer days, more daylight hours for the farmers to do their work in, and not that much news to speak of, but we did find a couple of very interesting stories that we have for you. And the first one was this guy that apparently tried to kill the Queen last year, and he has pleaded guilty to attempting to murder the Queen under the Treason Act. And there are lots of interesting things that we can get into, like the Treason Act, the last person that was found guilty under the Treason Act, who was actually given 5 years for firing blanks at the Queen in the 80s. And I just find that incredible. Somebody could actually have a gun, fire blanks at the Queen, and they just get 5 years under the Treason Act. And then you've got people today that are getting 6 or 7 years in prison just for reading a book, just for downloading a book. You just compare those two prison sentences is scandalous. But what was interesting about this case is that you were telling me, Max, that the guy was actually a Sikh as well, which we didn't realise before. Do you want to give us an outline of why this guy was trying to kill the Queen and what's been happening there?
Well, yeah, I first heard of this particular incident. It was around about sort of Christmas 2021, which is when it was Christmas Day 2021 that this individual, Jaswant Singh Chahal, was intercepted by a police officer in the grounds of Windsor Castle. But it wasn't mentioned at the time that he was a Sikh. It wasn't mentioned at the time that he was of immigrant stock. It was just mentioned that a British man has been arrested, blah, 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 in the way that always that these things are always done, hiding the race and ethnicity of the person committing the crime for obvious purposes of massaging public opinion so that people don't feel threatened by the presence of immigrants in our country. The thing was that this chap was dressed looking like something out of a horror film. Basically, he was all dressed in black, had a hood over his face, had a metal mask made with like little slits for his eyes so that he looked like some sort of maniac killer out of a horror film, and was carrying a crossbow. The police officer that intercepted him didn't realise initially that he was carrying a crossbow, but saw a hooded figure approaching, realised the guy was wearing a mask, and then challenged him. And it was then that he realised that this chap was carrying a crossbow, and he then ordered him to drop the crossbow and get down on his knees, which actually he did. So you know, he didn't sort of physically or violently try to resist arrest. But at the point where he was arrested, he said, "I'm here to kill the Queen." And apparently he's repeated that same phrase several times, which rather suggests that he could be suffering from some kind of psychological problem because of the fact that he went there dressed so bizarrely, dressed so aggressively, and then so meekly gave himself up, and then just kept repeating the phrase, "I'm here to kill the Queen." It's quite strange. But it turns out that several days before this incident took place, Jaswant Singh Chahal published on the internet a short podcast where he said what he was about to do, and then mentioned that what he was doing was in retaliation for the 1919 incident, which is has become known as the Amritsar massacre. And The first thing that sort of strikes me is that here's a young Sikh who presumably is either born in Britain or who has been given British citizenship, who over 100 years after this incident took place in India, the so-called Amritsar massacre, is still harbouring hostile thoughts towards Britain and the British people and the British monarchy, and wants retaliation or retribution for the people who were killed and injured during the Amritsar massacre. And it sort of made me think to myself about Norman Tebbit and Norman Tebbit's famous cricket test. And it's often, and it used to be often claimed by people who were promoting multiracialism, that immigrants and people of immigrant stock are just as British as the indigenous British people are, and feel just as passionately about Britain and the royal family and the British culture and everything else as we do, and that we shouldn't assume that they don't think the same way, people who promote multiracialism have constantly denigrated Norman Tebbit over his alleged cricket test. And his cricket test was, when the England cricket team play the West Indies or play India or Pakistan, who do the people cheer for? If they're cheering, his point was that if they cheered for England, then that showed that they had been successfully integrated into British society. Whereas if they still cheered for India, Pakistan or whatever, then it showed that they hadn't mentally integrated into a British identity. And the point is that this individual who carried the crossbow into Windsor Castle was not obviously not born when the Amritsar massacre took place. The Amritsar massacre had taken place more than 100 years previously, and yet still he quite obviously would fail the cricket test as described by Norman Tebbit. And so, that's quite a sort of an interesting thing to realise, isn't it?
Well, yeah, well, just thinking about that, I mean, your loyalty is always going to be to your family. It's always going to be to your extended family. And regardless of where you're living, I mean, you might like the territory which you are living in. You might like the landscape. You might like the institutions that have been set up by the establishment. You might like the laws. But your loyalty is always going to be to your family. And that is always going to come above everything else. And I think this shows that. I mean, it doesn't matter how many generations somebody may have been living within Britain, their loyalty is still going to be to their ancestors. That doesn't just suddenly get cut off and dropped when you move to another country. If you're to live in another country and you're the only scion of your family that is living in that other country, you don't suddenly stop thinking about your grandparents. You know, you don't suddenly stop thinking about your uncles, your aunts, your cousins. You don't suddenly become cut off from all of them, and your grandparents suddenly become the grandparents of somebody living up the street in the country that you're living in. You know, it's just an absolutely ridiculous idea. And it's only come about since this era of multiculturalism, basically, where we try to kid people that their loyalty is no longer to their family, but their loyalty is to our extended family. Why would that be? It's just a ridiculous idea. And this massacre in itself, I mean, it's very interesting that was the reason why he was trying to get his own back on the Queen. I mean, most people would probably say, well, what does that have to do with the Queen? She probably wasn't even born at this time. So he is basically saying, well, the state, the country which he lives in, the history of that people goes back to attacking what he sees as his people. So he is then going for the sovereign of that state to try and get some revenge for this. And you think, well, why would he be wanting to get revenge for this? And the reason for that is obviously he's been propagandized into seeing that the British did this terrible thing at the time. And at the time, I'm not quite so sure that the British people thought it was a terrible thing. At the time, they looked into it, and there were a lot of people that said that the guy that was responsible for the massacre had actually averted a far worse massacre by doing this and by showing strength. And from what I can see from looking into it, we have discussed this before on another episode, but the guy that was responsible for this massacre, he had said to the to the Indians, don't gather. The police had said to them, don't gather. There had been signs that had been put up saying, do not gather on the street. This, you know, this was a time of uprisings. The telegram had been cut. Railways had been diverted. It was after the end of the First World War. And obviously, during the war, you had a state of martial law because you had a world war that was going on. And the British Empire, India was one of the British Empire's territories. So they'd had all this martial law. So the Indians weren't happy about that. And there had been uprisings, there had been rebellions. So martial law had pretty much been brought in by this governor. And on that day, he put these signs up saying, do not gather. And it appears that the Indians didn't bother to obey the signs. They didn't bother to obey the police. They did gather. And he made an example of them. He shot at them, and they were in an area where they couldn't get out. And this was the Amritsar massacre. And one of the bits that I find interesting about this, looking into it, at the time they said that 200 people had been killed. And then after that, they said, oh, no, it was much, much more than that. It was 300 people, 600 people. But you would think if what he did was trying to set an example to stop an uprising, he would inflate the numbers of the people killed. They would want to say lots and lots of people were killed. This is what will happen to you if you engage in an uprising. So I find it suspicious that they say that actually the numbers were much higher than the 200 figure, which was actually given at the time, because I think they would have wanted to inflate the figures at the time and terrify the Indians into not carrying on with these uprisings. That is what was going on there. There was also something to do with a woman and calling along the street and all these sorts of things. And I know you know more details about it as well, Max. Do you want to go into some of those?
Yeah, the person who was in charge of this particular area was Brigadier General R. E. H. Dyer, who was a man who had a distinguished military career up until that point, been involved in lots of actions, had fought bravely during the First World War, had been mentioned in dispatches more than once. So he was an exemplary soldier, and he was in charge of a force of soldiers from the British Indian Army that was composed of Gurkhas, also composed of Sikhs, and also composed of, I believe, some Hindus as well. But it was those soldiers that obeyed his orders and fired on the people that had assembled at Amritsar. The notices that Brigadier General Dyer had posted around the town were notices under what was called the Rowlatt Act, and the Rowlatt Act was effectively a variant of the Riot Act that used to be read out to rioting crowds or crowds causing disorder in times gone by, which is effectively giving them a period of notice to disperse, and if they don't disperse, that force will be used to disperse them, and so these notices have been posted all around the area. There was a background of, as you mentioned, revolts against British rule. There had been a number of political assassinations. There was talk of particularly soldiers, Indians that had Indian nationals that had been conscripted into the British Indian Army during the First World War. And we hear a lot about how they fought on our side during the First World War. Well, when they came, what they were actually used for was to guard India and the Indian subcontinent against encroachment by the Germans, who had an empire of their own in parts of Africa. The troops, when they came back after the First World War, they wanted their independence, and they were prepared to use violence in order to get their independence. And so this was a particularly tumultuous period during the history of the Raj. And as a result of that, the Rowlatt Act had been enacted, where people could be instructed and ordered to leave a place where they had assembled to carry out either a demonstration or to begin a violent revolt and violent disorder. So Brigadier General Dyer had posted these notices during the few days prior to the actual incident that we're talking about here, the so-called massacre at Amritsar. A school teacher called Marcella Sherwood, who ran a school for Indian children, was cycling through the town of Amritsar, and she was then set upon by a crowd of people who pulled her off her bike and started to beat her up. And this would have been one of these incidents that you very often see in India and in places in Africa, where crowds just completely lose all sense of proportion and stamp on somebody and kick them to death. And this was what would it looked as though was going to happen to this lady, Marcella Sherwood. But luckily, some Indian people decided, they took pity on her and they helped her to escape the crowd, and so she was able to get away. But in order to make an example of what had happened there, Brigadier Dyer then published an edict instructing any people that used the street where this one had been attacked, any people using that street had to crawl along the street on their stomachs during the hours of daylight. Obviously, at that particular point, there was a curfew, and so during the hours of darkness, people weren't allowed to go out into the street anyway, and so this edict only applied during the hours of daylight.
Can I just point out that it also only lasted for a day or two as well? That's the only length of time that it could have lasted.
But the point is, it's an example of one of those instances where innocent British people who had gone out to the Punjab, gone out to India in order to educate the people of the subcontinent, were being attacked just purely because of their race. And so Marcella Sherwood would have been attacked just purely because of the fact that she was British. But the radical crowds who were all calling for revolution and revolt against British rule in India defied the Rowlatt Act notices that had been posted around the town, and they went to this ground which covered about 6 acres apparently, and they assembled there and they started to have some kind of a demonstration. Now, they all claim that the demonstration was entirely peaceful. I think that it may not have been entirely peaceful. I think that it's quite likely that there were elements within the crowd who were actually rioting and behaving aggressively. Other people may have been peaceable and may have been shocked by what confronted them. But the upshot of it was that Brigadier Dyer felt that situation in that particular place, in those gardens, had reached a point where it required him to demonstrate force in order to make the crowd disperse. The soldiers under his command obviously felt the same as well, because otherwise they wouldn't have fired. And so they fired on the crowd. And by the time the crowd had dispersed, originally it was estimated that 200 people had been killed. Subsequent estimates have been inflated. The figure that tends to get bandied about nowadays is that it was about 390 people that were killed. But there are some claims by the groups who were on the receiving end of the gunshot that the number of deaths was 1,500, which is massively larger than the official figures, or the figures that have been claimed by more reputable sources since. So it's an interesting time in British history. It's a time when an incident took place where there is some doubt as to quite what happened and quite the order of what happened. But it's quite obvious that that this Amritsar massacre, as it's called, took place at a time when the people maintaining law and order in the Raj felt under great threat and felt the need to respond with force in order to ensure that they maintained law and order effectively.
Yeah, basically they were being forcing this example through to prevent more uproar, more uprisings, I guess. I've got a couple of quotes here which I think are pertinent. Colonel Dyer later explained to a British inspector, "Some Indians crawl face downwards in front of their gods. I wanted them to know that a British woman is as sacred as a Hindu god, and therefore they have to crawl in front of her too." And that was his logic as to why they had to crawl along the street. He also authorised the indiscriminate public whipping of locals who came within a lathy length of a police officer. So I'm guessing that that would be like a metre or two. If they got too close to a police officer, they would also be whipped. And Marcella Sherwood, this is the woman that was attacked. And all you have to do is look at these news reports today of what happened to women that get attacked in India. I mean, it's absolutely horrific. This woman was very lucky that some of these Indians actually rescued her. They weren't all attacked. But Marcella Sherwood later defended Colonel Dyer, describing him as the saviour of the Punjab. And a lot of people at that time thought that he actually did the right thing. Another thing that I think we should pay attention to here is that at 9 o'clock on the morning of the supposed massacre, the acting military commander for Amritsar, Reginald Dyer and its environs, proceeded through the city with several city officials announcing the implementation of a pass system to enter or leave Amritsar, a curfew beginning at 8 p.m. that night, and a ban on all processions and public meetings of four or more persons. And the proclamation was read and explained in English, Urdu, Hindi, and Punjabi, and it says here, but few paid it any heed or appear to have learned of it until later. So he had the officials walking through the city announcing this, shouting this out, that they should not be gathering. Meanwhile, local police had received intelligence of a planned meeting through word of mouth and plainclothes detectives in the crowds. Dyer was informed of the meeting and returned to his base at around 1:30 to decide how to handle it. So it's obviously insubordination. That's what's going on there. So he wanted to set an example. So once they had all gathered in there, he shot them. Obviously, it is horrific. They found a lot of bodies were at the bottom of the well, and obviously this Sikh lad who had British citizenship 100 years later. He was still concerned about this and wanted to take revenge for this. And yet you have to think, well, how many others of these people that our government have invited into the country and given citizenship also have these grudges against the British people? Obviously, this guy just went for rent for the Queen, but we also have Islamic jihadis, Islamic extremists, who also have a grudge against Christians and British people, and they've tried to carry out terrorist acts. And I think when this first happened, that was the suspicion that a lot of civic nationalists would have had. They would have been thinking, well, this was probably a Muslim. It's very surprising to find out that it is a Sikh. But again, if we didn't have multiculturalism, if our government had not invited in peoples from all around the world, peoples that more often than not actually have a grudge against the British because of the way they've been propagandized today, if our government had not invited them into our country, then there wouldn't be the risk of these sorts of things happening. I mean, because you cannot change the fact that they are going to feel aggrieved at what happened. And whether the British were in the right or in the wrong, or whatever the number of people that were killed or not is, the fact of the matter is that there is a certain percentage of the Sikhs who are going to feel like this. You know, they probably all feel as if this was a terrible thing and it shouldn't have happened. But a certain percentage of them are going to think that this was deliberately done. It was a racial thing or it was a religious thing. And they're going to feel aggrieved. They're going to feel that they have a right to go and take revenge. And that's what matters. You know, not whether the British were in the right or not the number of people that were killed, but the fact that there is this perception amongst this community, the Sikh community, that this was a terrible thing that happened, and that the British were responsible for it. And a lot of that is to do with the propagandizing that they get in the mainstream media, which doesn't tell people today about all the wonderful things that the British did for the people that they were ruling over. How it says here, this woman went out there, she was teaching 600 Indian children, and it was because of the schools that we set up for them, that we were able to say to them, yes, we'll hand the country over to you now, now that you're sufficiently educated enough to be able to run it. Because don't forget, it was run before the British. It was just run by these Muslim warlords and Hindu warlords that were abusing the population. The British went over there. We did away with this tradition that they had of setting fire to the women once their husband died. They would set fire to them while they were still alive. It was called sati. We got rid of the human sacrifice aspect of these thuggy cults. We got rid of slavery. We did all sorts of things to help the Indians out. We built transportation, infrastructure, telecommunications. We built them hospitals. We built them schools, railways all the way across the country. We did all these things for them. And yes, there were bad things that happened, such as this massacre. There were famines, which apparently when you look into them, you realize that, you know, there had always been famines in India, and the British did try to put things in place to prevent them. I did see the other day on I forget what it was called, but it's an official website which has been set up for Truth in History, and they were pointing out that this perception that we have of these deliberate famines, Winston Churchill setting up a deliberate famine, that wasn't what happened. And the fact of the matter is that they did used to have these famines. So things are getting taken out of all proportion. Nobody puts in a good word for what the British actually did, and you end up with people with a grudge against the British. And then you've also got this ethnic aspect, where I think people's loyalty is always going to be more to their extended family than it's going to be to the country that you're living in. And that is just logic. And once you think about it in that way, you understand it, and you understand why we have all these problems within society today, that at the root of them all, it's multiculturalism. Because, I mean, it could be that this Dyer was entirely within his rights to do what he did, and it was only 100 people that died, and they were all armed with weapons, and there was going to be a big uprising. That doesn't matter. The fact of the matter is, the Sikhs feel aggrieved at this, the Indians feel aggrieved at this, they feel that it was a wrong thing, and because of our government's immigration policy, we have large numbers of them within our country. Now, I think it's very unlikely that the Sikhs would do something like this. I'm very, very surprised that this was a Sikh. So it may also be that the guy had, maybe he was schizophrenic, maybe he had mental issues, something like that. But I mean, there's all sorts of things we could talk about with this, Max. Do you want to comment on any of those?
The only thing I'd like to add, really, is that as far as Jaswant Singh Chahal is concerned, he never knew anybody that died at Amritsar. He was never personally acquainted with anybody because he's just too young. In fact, his parents probably never knew anybody that was killed at Amritsar. And it's possible that even his grandparents never knew anybody that was killed at Amritsar. It may have been his great-grandparents. So the point is that this is a stupid grudge. That's, you know, if somebody does another person a disservice, then that person may hold a grudge in extreme cases for the rest of their life. But the instances where grudges are held longer than a human lifetime, longer than several generations, is always where the incident in question is politicized, and where an ethnicity, an ethnic group, regard it as being a grudge that they have to hold, that becomes multi-generational, and wherever in the world there are multi-generational grudges held between one ethnic group and another ethnic group, it always results in perpetual violence and ill feeling, and this is one of the strongest reasons, really, why we need to dismantle the multicultural and multiracial societies that have been created in European countries in recent decades, because if we don't, then all of these multi-generational grudges, and I'm sure there are lots more, all will come to the fore, and they will never be forgotten, and they will be a bone of contention forevermore.
Yeah, and these ancestral grudges, they're not based on the country that somebody lives in. You know, they're based on ancestral ties. You know, we've effectively said to ourselves, oh, there's no such thing as ancestral ties. If somebody comes here from another country, they've got no ties to their family or their forefathers. They're just going to believe that they're exactly the same as the ethnic British. And it's just a nonsense. You know, it's as much of a nonsense as to say that you know, if you move to another country, you immediately forget all about your immediate family, and you adopt a family in the country that you've moved to. It's just such a crazy idea that we've told ourselves that ancestral ties just do not exist. And things like this, you know, they just prove that these ancestral ties do exist. And your loyalty is not so much to the country that you live in, but your loyalty is to your family and your immediate family. And that is always going to come above the loyalty to the country that you live in. You know, the same way as your loyalty to your immediate family is going to come before your loyalty to the other citizens of the country, if you see what I mean. I mean, maybe people say, well, that's wrong, that shouldn't be. But it just is, because blood is thicker than water. You know, it's a very old saying that we have, and it's very truthful. Blood and ancestral ties is always going to be more important than what country that you live in. I mean, you could live in any country around the world, couldn't you? You know, you could be an expat, but your links and your connections are always going to be to the rest of your family, wherever they are, wherever they live in the world. You know, somebody, you know, if you have a family member and they move to another country, they don't stop being a family member. You don't stop having your loyalty to them because they're living in another country, and they don't automatically assume loyalty to that country that they are living in. But they do naturally have a loyalty to you and to your family and vice versa. And that is at the center of, you know, that's at the center of everything, not individuality. You know, individuals cannot exist on their own. Individuals can only exist if there is a family around them. You know, when you're a child, you can't do anything for yourself. You have to rely on your family. And the nation is built up from various families. The smallest individual unit in the nation is the family, and the nation itself is an extended family. It's all the extended families that are interconnected through their ancestry, and that is the original meaning of the word nation. And it's still there. We can pretend it's not there, but, you know, it still is there. This just proves that it is still there. And you can say, well, this guy was mentally disturbed. That's why he tried to kill the Queen. But the fact that, you know, he had this grudge shows that within that community, there is still this grudge. And you can see that in the way that Wikipedia talks about this Amritsar massacre. You can see that the Indians still feel aggrieved about it. And if it wasn't for these ancestral ties, you know, that they wouldn't be feeling aggrieved about it. They'd be thinking, well, that was a completely different group of people in a completely different country 100 years ago. It's got nothing to do with me. But they don't. They think, well, they were related to my great-great-grandparents in some way. So it does have something to do with me. You know, it's all to do with family ties, everything. And, you know, we just pretend that they don't exist. Do you want to add anything else to that, Max? Or
No, I think we've said all that can be said, really, about that.
Oh, should we get into our Greatest Britons, then?
Yes, that'd be great.
Yeah, let's talk about Sir Oswald Ernold Moseley, the 6th Baronet. And what we were talking about last week is how he had crossed the floor and he was now with the Labour Party. And he had just been pipped at the post by Neville Chamberlain by 77 votes or something like that. So we'll have a look at some of his travels now. Among his many travels, Moseley travelled to British India, accompanied by Lady Cynthia, in 1924, and his father-in-law's past as Viceroy of India allowed for the acquaintance of various personalities along the journey, and they travelled by ship and stopped briefly in Cairo. So they had a look at Egypt as well, and this shows us that Oswald Moseley was well travelled. He'd been out to India, having initially arrived in Ceylon, present-day Sri Lanka. The journey then continued through mainland India. They spent their initial days in the government house of Ceylon, followed by Madras and then Calcutta, where the governor at the time was Lord Lytton. And Moseley met Mahatma Gandhi through C.F. Andrews, a clergyman and an intimate friend of the so-called Indian saint, as Moseley described him. They met in Kedah, where Gandhi was quick to invite him to a private conference in which Gandhi was the chairman. They enjoyed each other's company for the short time they were together, and Moseley later called Gandhi a sympathetic personality of subtle intelligence. So quite clearly, there is no hatred of skin colours here. Moseley thought quite highly of Gandhi. And Mahatma Gandhi, he was a nationalist. He wanted to get rid of the British rule. So I think you can see that there is, you know, there is kindred spirits there, basically, between two nationalists. I do find it interesting that he thought highly of him here. Unfortunately, Gandhi was shot as well, wasn't he? It was a political thing that the guy that actually shot him didn't want the partition to happen. After the British left, India was split between Pakistan and India, and the guy that actually shot him was concerned that this was going to happen, or that had actually happened when he did shoot him. So that's very unfortunate. And that's what happened when Britain actually left India. There was a huge massacre between the Indians themselves, between the Muslims and the Hindus. There was all sorts of rapes went on. You can read about it in Wikipedia. But all of that was being prevented by the British administration. You know, if it's because as soon as the British administration left, that's what happened. The Muslims and the Hindus were right at it straight away, trying to kill one another. And it was the British that were actually putting a stop to that, which gets left out today when they're talking about India. But he would have seen that.
But what this also shows, really, the way in which Mosley got on with Mahatma Gandhi, really, is that far from being a kind of a strutting, arrogant fool in the way that Mosley is often portrayed by the media nowadays. Mosley was somebody who had very well-developed skills of diplomacy. He had the ability to empathise with another person's point of view. And he was somebody who was genuinely charming and had charisma that made him an attractive person.
And he had respect for people that wanted to do things for their people. Obviously, he saw Gandhi as a representative of the Hindu people rather than something to do with the country. It was for the Hindus that Gandhi wanted to have India rule itself. Well, back in Parliament in 1926, the Labour-held seat of Smethwick fell vacant, and Mosley returned to Parliament on a Labour ticket after winning the resulting by-election on the 21st of December. Now, I do find that interesting that he was a Conservative politician before and he got voted into Parliament, and now he's a Labour politician and he gets voted into Parliament again. You know, it's sort of like regardless of which party that he is in. Mosley felt the campaign was dominated by Conservatives' attacks on him for being too rich, including claims that he was covering up his wealth. I mean, that's interesting as well, isn't it? You know, the Labour Party is supposed to be the working class party, yet obviously he appealed to people who were socialists. In 1927, he mocked the British fascists as black-shirted buffoons, making a cheap imitation of ice cream sellers. And the ILP, the Independent Labour Party, elected him to Labour's National Executive Committee. So he obviously didn't quite understand fascism at that time. Mosley and Cynthia were committed Fabians in the 1920s. And as we've talked about before, the Fabians were also involved in the Eugenics Society at the time and at the start of the 1930s. And Mosley appears in a list of names of Fabians from Fabian News and the Fabian Society annual report of 1929 to 1931. He was Kingsway Hall lecturer in 1924 and the Livingstone Hall lecturer in 1931. So I think what we can see here is that he's really concerned about his ethnicity. He's concerned about the British people. And that's why he's trying out these different political parties. And he's trying to find which one is best representative, which one is going to do its best for the British people. And I guess that's why he got caught up with the Fabians as well. And I think back here at this time, it wasn't so much right or left. Clearly, it was the person himself is the reason why people are going to vote somebody in rather than the party that they represent. I guess that's what we can learn from the fact that he was voted in as Labour as well as Conservative. It was him, the man himself, that people wanted rather than the party. And perhaps the differences between the parties weren't quite so defined as they are now. Any thoughts?
I think it's quite obvious that Mosley's ideas transcended capitalism as it had been known up to that point, and also transcended socialism as it had become known up to that point. So he was somebody who was somebody that anybody meeting him would have regarded him as somebody that's got something special. And I think that's the reason why he was so successful during this time.
Well, yeah, we've heard plenty of reports giving the descriptions of his speeches, that he didn't use any notes for his speeches, and quite mesmerising. Next, we come to what he was probably most famous for before becoming a fascist, and that was his memorandum. Realising the economic uncertainty that was facing the nation because of the death of its domestic industry, Mosley put forwards a scheme in the Mosley Memorandum that called for high tariffs to protect British industries from international finance and transform the British Empire into an autarkic trading bloc, for state nationalisation of main industries, for higher school leaving ages, for pensions to reduce the labour surplus, and for a programme of public works to solve interwar poverty and unemployment. Furthermore, the memorandum laid out the foundations of the corporate state, which intended to combine businesses, workers and the government into one body as a way to obliterate class conflict and to make the British economy healthy again. And it was this corporate state that actually, this idea for the corporate state, that actually came from Catholicism, and it grew from that into fascism. So you can see here a lot of nationalist ideas, being self-sufficient, the autarkic trading bloc here, nationalisation of main industries, high tariffs to protect British industries from international finance. So, you know, he's looking at international finance, and a big programme of public works to solve interwar poverty and unemployment, which is, of course, what the National Socialists did in Germany, building up the roads, building up the houses, doing lots of things to increase the enjoyment of the citizens, and also to make sure they had more money so that they could spend it. And then when they spend the money, they're obviously going to need more products, and to need more products, you need to have more people working. You know, a great way to get people out of unemployment is a huge public works program. So he laid all of this out, and also obliterate class conflict. Obviously, he's not talking about internationalism here. He's talking about nationalism. You know, have the classes working together rather than class war. Class war was the communist idea, wasn't it? The workers warring against the bosses, whereas the nationalist idea is the workers working together with the bosses, and the bosses understanding the importance of the worker, and the worker understanding the importance of the boss, or the intellectual class, rather than communism, which just seeks to wipe out the intellectual class and steal everything for the workers. So you see here that wasn't his way of looking at this. Even though he was in the Labour Party, he wanted to get rid of class conflict and make the British economy healthy again. Any thoughts on this, Max?
Well, as I said a bit earlier on, transcending capitalism and socialism. And so what he's done is he's picked the best elements of capitalism and picked the best elements of socialism and put them together, blended them together into a political belief system that was very appealing at the time, and that then continues with him throughout future years as well.
Well, this must have been what led him into fascism as well, I think, you know, looking into this. Mosley published this memorandum because of his dissatisfaction with the laissez-faire attitudes held by both Labour and the Conservative Party, and their passivity towards the ever-increasing globalisation of the world, and he thus looked to a modern solution to fix a modern problem. But it was rejected by the Cabinet and by the Parliamentary Labour Party, and in May 1930, Mosley resigned from his ministerial position. At the time, the weekly liberal-leaning paper The Nation and Athenaeum described his move as, "The resignation of Sir Oswald Mosley is an event of capital importance in domestic politics. We feel that Sir Oswald has acted rightly, as he has certainly acted courageously, in declining to share any longer in the responsibility for inertia." And in October, he attempted to persuade the Labour Party conference to accept the memorandum, but he was defeated again. So he must be starting to get really annoyed now that the government are not doing anything about the unemployment. They're not doing anything for the people. And he doesn't want to be known as somebody that legitimised that by still staying within his ministerial position. So this shows that he has a lot of integrity, I think. I mean, some people will say, well, you know, when these politicians, when they resign, that means they're no longer going to have any influence, that it's just a cop-out, I'm resigning from the party. But at the same time, it means that they're not going to be blamed for something that that happens with the party, rather like Ian Duncan Smith. He was working on reforms to the benefit system, and when he realised that it was actually harming people more than it was helping them, he resigned and made a big thing of the fact that the system that he wanted to bring in had been warped and distorted so that it was harming people, which I thought was very principled. So I think you've got a similar thing here, haven't we? You know, Mosley is resigning because he doesn't want to give legitimacy to a government that is refusing to do the right thing for the people. Any thoughts?
Well, Mosley made lots of speeches during his lifetime where he describes as one of the enemies of progress the men with feet of clay. It's quite a common phrase that he's used, and by that he means men who procrastinate and just don't do anything. The point is that if you have a government that endlessly procrastinates and doesn't actually do anything, then nothing will ever get better, and things will only ever get worse. If you become a man of action and you identify the course of action that's most likely to bring results and you try it, it may succeed, in which case everybody will be happy. You may fail at it, but if you fail at it, at least what you've done is you've discovered one way that you then know doesn't work, and you can then choose another way and have a go at that. But if you just procrastinate and don't do anything, then problems will never get solved. And this is one of the core elements or themes of Mosley's speeches, that, you know, we were being held back by people with feet of clay that couldn't move without falling over, effectively.
So much of Parliament business is just theatre as well. It's just making mountains out of molehills and pretending to be doing something when nothing ever really changes. And that was always a big criticism of the democracy that we actually had in Britain, as so much of it is just amateur dramatics. And the Mosley memorandum won the support of the economist John Maynard Keynes, who stated that it was a very able document and illuminating. And Keynes also wrote, "I like the spirit which informs the document. A scheme of national economic planning to achieve a right, or at least a better, balance of our industries between the old and the new, between agriculture and manufacture, between home development and foreign investment, and wide executive powers to carry out the details of such a scheme. That is what it amounts to. The manifesto offers us a starting point for thought and action. It will shock, it must do so, the many good citizens of this country who have laissez-faire in their craniums, their consciences, and their bones. But how anyone professing and calling himself a socialist can keep away from the manifesto is a more obscure matter." So I'm guessing he tried to get the Labour Party to go along with this, but they're internationalists. So I guess he's maybe starting to think more in a nationalist way now, and blending the nationalism with the socialism, looking out for the British people, but at all aspects of society, and getting them working together. And John Maynard Keynes, I mean, he was a very important economist. So if he thought highly of this gave it credit. It must have been an embarrassment to the government to be ignoring this, I think, particularly for the Labour Party. Well, 30 years later, in 1961, Richard Crossman wrote, "This brilliant memorandum was a whole generation ahead of Labour thinking. As his book, The Greater Britain, focused on the issues of free trade, the criticisms against globalisation that he formulated can be found in critiques of contemporary globalisation. He warns nations that buying cheaper goods from other nations may seem appealing, but ultimately will ravage domestic industry and lead to large unemployment, as was seen in the 1930s. He argues that trying to challenge the 50-year-old system of free trade exposes industry in the home market to the chaos of world conditions, such as price fluctuation, dumping, and the competition of sweated labour, which results in the lowering of wages and industrial decay. So we can see today what the end results are of globalisation. It's everybody working, it's women working as well as men working, and still not earning enough to provide for their family. Even though you've got two wages going, you've got all this control, this financial control over everything. And now we've even got this great reset where you have stakeholders that all have an equal amount of importance. And one of the stakeholders is the government. Another one is the non-governmental organisations. Another one is the corporations. So government itself has been relegated to just simply being another stakeholder in the way that things are run. And the corporations and the finances has been raised up to being an equal to the government openly. I mean, it wasn't open before, but that it's openly being done now, and that's all as a result of globalization. So he was pointing this out, Mosley was pointing this out in the 30s, and then you got somebody else here in the 60s writing. This was so ahead of its time. Just look at what's happening now, and you can still see these problems that are happening today. In a newspaper feature, Mosley was described as a strange blend of J.M. Keynes and Major Douglas of credit fame. And from July 1930, Mosley began to demand that government must be turned from a talk shop into a workshop. And this last bit I found very interesting. In 1992, the then UK Prime Minister John Major examined Mosley's ideas in order to find an unorthodox solution to the aftermath of the 1990 to 91 economic recession. 60 years later, you know, his memorandum is still being looked at, and none of these parties actually put it into practice. None of them actually did anything about it. And it's quite surprising that John Major was actually admitting, looking at Oswald Mosley's ideas. Any thoughts on this, Max?
Well, the phrase talk shop and workshop, they again reinforce what I was saying about Mosley, which is that he was constantly frustrated and confounded by people who just simply wanted to procrastinate, who didn't really have any ideas of their own, but didn't want anybody else's ideas to be implemented in case it sort of reflected badly on them. And so, you know, these are, again, the men with the feet of clay. And he, you know, wanted the parliament to be turned from a talking shop into a workshop. What he wanted was action to be taken. Because only when action is taken can you find out whether the idea that you've got will actually work or not.
Yeah, it's a false economy as well, buying cheaper goods from somebody else outside of the country, because that means that all that money that you're actually buying for those goods is being siphoned off into somebody else's economy. You know, if it's a little bit more, but it's still within your own country, or within, you know, the British Empire is what he was saying here. But if it's within your own country, then that raises up the living standards of everybody that's in your nation, rather than that money being siphoned off and being used to raise up the living standards of someone else's nation. So it's a completely false economy to be buying cheaper goods from outside of your own country. It's an extremely selfish way of doing things. It's when you look at when you look at people as individuals rather than as whole nations in itself, because I mean that's going to make more money for one individual, isn't it, who sets up the deal. But it's not going to raise the living standards of the whole nation, because all the money that's involved in it is going off to this other group in this other country. So it's all a part of globalization. And I guess he must have gone.
I was just going to say, I think I remember sort of mentioning in a previous podcast that we've done about a chap that I encountered some years ago, whose entire career had been had involved him. He'd started his own company, but what his company did was that they bought up machinery from the UK and then sold that machinery to countries in the third world, India primarily, where they then went, transported the machinery out there and then set up the factories so that whole industries could be just transferred from the UK to the third world, solely because the workers there would work for less. And so therefore, those industries, once transplanted, would produce goods at a much lower price than could be economically determined over here in the UK by UK manufactured goods, so effectively what happened was in order to have more cheaply manufactured goods from abroad, Not only did we import their goods, but we actually exported our industry to them so that they could then produce those goods more cheaply, so that we could import them. And this is the aberrant thinking that existed during much of the last century, where people pursued a policy of capitalism, where everything was hinged on money, and it was regarded as, you know, the laissez-faire tactic was to always buy the cheapest and not to think of the social cost of turning your back on the home industry and buying the cheapest, which inevitably would always come from abroad.
Yeah, and who does it serve to be doing that? Because obviously it doesn't serve the British people. The people that it serves, who always benefit from this, is international finance. They're the ones that benefit from people buying goods from abroad instead of paying and investing in industry within their own country to make their own goods there. It's international finance. And the point that I was also going to bring up is, you know, after the fall of the British Empire, I think because he wanted to see Europe as a nation. So he was there. And what he meant by that was like free trade between European countries to raise up European living standards. And he was looking at Europeans as all being one giant extended family. It was a racial thing because people try to link that in with the European Union. And the difference is the European Union just accepts it's not a racial thing, obviously. It's not based on ethnicity. And they want to import people from all over the world into the European Union. We see that with the lax immigration policy. And, you know, we also read Coudenhove-Kalergi's idea of what the European Union was going to be. And it was going to create a new man that was going to look like the modern day Egyptians and be a blend of Europeans and Africans. And his award, the Coudenhove-Kalergi Award, is still given out to leaders of the European Union. I think they give it a different name now. Originally, it was the Coudenhove-Kalergi Award. So that was very different from Mosley's idea, where you would have the different ethnicities of Europe seeing themselves as Europeans and working together to achieve things, and having this being shielded from the rest of the world, being shielded from the globalization, and just working for ourselves, which I think that's a very good idea. It's very different to the European Union today. And his Europe a Nation speech, that is one of the speeches that is available. So he was starting to get very dissatisfied by this time. Now that he's come out with this great idea, this memorandum, and both the mainstream parties are not interested in it. He gets turned down at the Labour Party conference. So dissatisfied with the Labour Party, Mosley founded what was called the New Party. Its early parliamentary contests, that's the New Party, in the 1931 Ashton-under-Lyne by-election and subsequent by-elections, arguably had a spoiler effect in splitting the left-wing vote and allowing Conservative candidates to win. But despite this, the organisation gained support among many Labour and Conservative politicians who agreed with his corporatist economic policy. And among these were Aneurin Bevin and Harold Macmillan. Mosley's corporatism was complemented by Keynesianism, with Robert Skidelsky stating Keynesianism was his great contribution to fascism. It also gained the endorsement of the Daily Mail newspaper, headed at the time by Harold Harmsworth, later created the first Viscount Rothermere. So people are associating him more with the Labour than with the Conservatives, and they're seeing that he's splitting the left-wing vote. But of course, nationalism and fascism today, you know, it's seen as being far right. It's not seen as being left-wing. But you can see here that these ideas of looking after your people that are central to nationalism, you know, they are seen as being left-wing at this time. So it changes from being left to being right. And obviously, as nationalists, we say that we're neither left nor right. We just want to do what's best for our people. Well, the New Party increasingly inclined itself to fascist policies. But Mosley was denied the opportunity to get his party established when, during the Great Depression, the 1931 general election was suddenly called, and the party's candidates, including Mosley himself running in Stoke, which had been held by his wife, lost the seats they held and won none. As the New Party gradually became more radical and authoritarian, many previous supporters defected from it. And shortly after the 1931 election, Moseley was described by the Manchester Guardian thusly. When Sir Oswald Moseley sat down after his Free Trade Hall speech in Manchester, and the audience, stirred as an audience rarely is, rose and swept a storm of applause towards the platform, who could doubt that here was one of those root and branch men who have been thrown up from time to time in the religious, political and business story of England. First, that gripping audience is arrested, then stirred, and finally, as we have said, swept off its feet by a tornado of peroration yelled at the defiant high pitch of a tremendous voice. And peroration means something like a great applause at the end of a great building up to a crescendo, apparently. I mean, it's basically...
exhortation.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, it's basically very, very high praise from the Manchester Guardian here. So it's surprising that they lost the seats, to be honest, because more and more people were supporting him, and he was so compelling with the people, as you can see here, everybody stamping their feet and a great roar of applause, and yet somehow they lost their seats. Any thoughts on the new party, Max?
Well, I think it just marks a gradual progression from trying to modify the politics of the old parties to looking to newer parties and newer movements and newer ideas as the means of putting his ideas into action. And so I think that it was inevitable that Moseley would seek out something new if he was constantly having doors closed on him by the Conservative and the Labour Party. And the new big thing that was happening in Europe at the time was the rise of fascism and National Socialism in Germany.
That's interesting. He's not bringing the traditionalism into it either. I mean, he's calling this party the new party, capitalising on this is going to be a completely different way of doing things. But really, it grew out of corporatism, which, as I say, came from Catholicism. And then you had fascism. So they were looking to the past in a way, but more concentrating on being modern. And this is a completely different way of doing things. We need to have a big shake up in government. We need a new way of doing things because we now have a post-industrial world, I guess, is the way that he was looking at it. But the politics hasn't changed for 100 years or so, and these parties that we have, neither of them are going to go along with his plans, so he's going to start his own party. And I think we'll leave that there, and we'll get into the British Union of Fascists in the next episode.
I just wanted to add before we quite finish it, because it's apropos to something you just said, the Roman Catholic Church was a great supporter at that time of an economic school of thought called distributism. And this is something that becomes more prominent and becomes incorporated into the thinking of the British Union of Fascists. So that's an illustration of the Catholic influence that there was on Moseley's early development.
That is what I'm thinking of when I'm saying about corporatism. Yeah, it was the distributism. That's where this corporatism came from, and then the fascism. So that's really helpful, Max. But I think we'll leave that here for now, and we'll get into the British Union of Fascists in the next episode. Thank you very much for coming on today.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.